You know, just before I came here, I looked on leo.org, what is for this?
We too.
But I didn't get an answer. So I don't know. Ashamed to say.
I think it's a German thing. It's like a really bad review of an angry critic.
Ah.
Who's like, you know, like, I don't know, but I don't know if there is a word.
It's like,
are there
saying.
Bad critics outside of Germany? That would be the question.
Yeah, of course there are.
Roasting is a fine compromise.
Oh, a roasting, like a, yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah. Roasting and Prejudice, an international podcast about theatre. Today with me, Damien Rebgetz. The name of the show, To Act or Not to Act? Who gives a fuck?
Welcome to Roasting and Prejudice. Your hosts, as usual, Bene Mahler
and Maximilian Zippenauer. Welcome to the first edition of Verriss und Vorurteil in the English tongue. Why in English, some might ask? Well, maybe we want to develop this radio show into the first worldwide celebrated podcast about German Stadttheater. Or maybe this was the masochistic request of our guest today, the performer, musician, entertainer and soon-to-be director Damien Rebgetz. Hello, Damien. Schön, dass du da bist.
Hey. Well done. That was good. I understood everything.
Okay, der Punkt ist, Damien spricht perfekt Deutsch, but he told us before the show, Melville like, he rather prefers not to. So we got to bite in the sour apple and do the show in English. I even brought, Max, bitte gib mal hoch, Oxford Dictionary.
Oh, wow, you guys are prepared.
It's one lingual, yeah, of course.
Oh, that's good.
Do you know these things, like the one lingual dictionaries that, like, if you don't know a word, you have to look up 10 other words to get the definition of the word you don't know?
Yeah, well, actually, I always got in trouble in the German school that I didn't have a one, only German.
Well, we'll give our best anyway, and we are glad you're here, Damien, and we'd like to talk about your very unorthodox way of becoming an actor in Germany after already having had a sparkling career as a soprano singer in the Brisbane surfer community. And of course, we'll talk about your new piece, Nirvana's Last.
But before we start, on the off chance that someone out there listening might never have heard of the great Damien Rebgetz so far, our colleague Anna Landefeld has prepared a few most probably touching words.
Für einen kurzen Moment an jedem Tag schließt der Theatermacher Damien Rebgetz seine Augen. Er sieht dann Australien, seine Heimat, den Himmel azurblau, so hoch und weich wie seine Stimme als junger Sopran, der er einst war. Ein zierlicher Widerspruch war Rebgetz gewesen zum irdischen Macho-Gitarrengeschrammel an den lagerfeuerhellen Stränden Brisbanes. Davor gerettet haben ihn Brecht und Kurt Weil, die Kunst also, das Singen noch genauer gesagt. Sie haben ihm das Aschenbechergrau des Berliner Himmels verschrieben. Unter dem wird Rebgetz Theatermacher, verzaubert die freie Szene dort derart, dass man ihm die geldgoldenen Sonnenuntergänge Münchens empfiehlt. Fluch oder Segen? Ein letztes Trotzjahr singt, spielt, inszeniert Rebgetz an den Kammerspielen. Was kommt dann noch? Und was danach?
Damien, you came to Germany to trace Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. Mm-hmm. Do you remember your first impressions of German theater?
My first really memorable impression of German theater, I think, is going to watch Rimini Protocol in Halle. And it was like, I think it was a piece called Behind the News or something. And so it was really not German theater, what I had imagined. But, I mean, it is German theater, this documentary style. Without actors.
You came from Australia, and yeah. When I'm traveling, I'm always surprised what totally different concepts exist of the word theater. Mm. What is theater like in Australia? And schreibt man es mit E am Ende oder nicht? Is this British English?
We use American British English, so it's RE. Well, theater in Australia, I think, is like, it's quite different, obviously, to Germany, because we don't have all these Stadttheater. I come from the Gold Coast. The theatre on the Gold Coast consisted of like amateur musicals and sometimes like performances by bands or comedians, but not really a theatre there. In the next city's Brisbane, and they have like an opera company and a theatre company. So you don't have the same kind of scale of these institutions providing constant productions. And I mean, Brisbane is a city of like 2 to 3 million. So it's like a huge difference. I mean, Munich has how many theatres and how many people? I think like 3 theatres just for
1 million people.
And only 1 million people. So it's a very different kind of landscape.
It's interesting because in Germany, theatre, at least, I mean, there are like, you started off with the off scene, but you also know like the classical German theater, where it's always like this intellectual impetus to have some, I don't know, like some Goethe or Schiller or whatever.
Yeah. Well, there's Shakespeare, but obviously that he's not Australian. but I never watched Goethe before and I never watched Schiller. But there is Brecht. And it's funny that you talk about Brecht because first I studied like classical music and then I studied musicals. And the only thing that crossed over was Brecht and Kurt Weill. And there was like, I was fascinated with like the space of it still being like form. Like it's not like a completely commercial theater, but it's still, it's not totally like the opera and form and everything. And, but then when I went to Germany, it was more difficult to connect with Brecht because it was like it was much more controlled. I got the sense, I think. So in English, you can really modernize it by like translating it.
Finally, Trommeln in der Nacht.
Yeah, that was interesting because it was the first time I'd done Brecht, and it was this historical production by Christopher Rüping, but it was pretty much the original text, apart from a few little things.
So you did it in a classical way, in an Australian way.
Old school. Yeah, yeah.
Costumes.
I did a true Australian alienation technique, Brechtian. Yeah.
Okay. I was always very afraid of Australia because of all
the animals.
The animals. I think that's something you probably hear a lot. But I was thinking, like, how does being an Australian equip you as an actor? And I was thinking, maybe it's a cliche, but you are familiar with so many dangerous things, snakes, spiders, sharks, drunk, mine workers, I don't know. growing up in this environment, you have to be constantly cautious. How did your Australian survival instinct help you in the German theater community? A scene where, as they say, are as many snakes in Australia.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I am also scared of snakes. And I actually grew up in the very north of Australia, like near Darwin. And there were lots of snakes and crocodiles and also jellyfish. Like box jellyfish that can kill you. That was my number one fear, was more like box jellyfish and crocodiles as a child. And when I went to Germany, I found, after living there for a few months, I was walking through a park at night and I was like stomping my feet. I just actually did it. I was stomping my feet because when you walk through grass, you should always stomp your feet.
So the snakes go away.
So that snakes go away. And I always did it. And then I was like, oh, I don't have to do it anymore. Yeah. So how has that helped me in the German theatre landscape?
Are you stamping through the theatre?
Yeah, maybe. I'm stamping to scare the other snakes away, but I'm not sure if it's working. I mean, actually, I don't find there's not so many snakes, I think.
More jellyfish or?
Maybe it helps me. Yeah. Yeah, what are they like? Maybe spiders?
Tarantulas.
Yeah. But I'm pretty neurotic, so I think I can probably imagine that anyone is a snake also, depending on how I wake up that day. Yeah.
It's very crazy where you grow up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a small island.
Yeah. First I was born in Darwin, and then I lived on like Bathurst Island for about 3 years. And that's where I started school. And my father was a doctor in a community. The people there are called Tiwi people, and that's the culture of the islands. It's called Niue. And so I was like, I grew up there. My oldest memories are of that place in a school in which I was the only white kid. And then we also lived in Kakadu National Park. And funnily enough, because you like animals, that was when my father, who's a doctor, treated Paul Hogan when he was doing Crocodile Dundee. And my other friend, his father, like, gave the buffalo the shot that made it fall. I don't know if you know the movie.
I know the movie, but I don't remember the buffalo. There is a buffalo?
So I thought it was Paul King Hogan, Hughes. Like, mesmerizes a buffalo. And
I remember it. And then he, like...
So he was the vet. Anyway, there was a vet. And going off the topic. But then at the age of 9, my family moved to the East Coast, to Gold Coast near Brisbane. And that was like a big shock because it was like moving from the country to the city. Suddenly there was like all these different channels on television and there was popular culture and fashion and surf culture. Oh, and you could actually swim in the ocean without the fear of crocodiles or like there were sharks, but they had shark nets. But I still had fears.
Sounds terrible.
I really had a lot of fears still of the jellyfish and the sharks. So I didn't really adapt well to becoming a surfer within a quite strong macho surf culture. And instead I dreamt of escaping and doing theatre and opera or musicals.
It's a great contrast. You were a boy soprano and you moved through some talent shows.
What's
this about this story?
So, you know, Australia, Australia is a strange country in the sense that it's like this European civilization, culture within a faraway stolen country. So nearby was a singing teacher. And she was like an opera singing teacher. So my mum took me to lessons with her. And it turned out I was like a boy soprano. But I learned like Mozart and Schubert and also Italian songs. but there wasn't really anywhere to sing them on the Gold Coast because, as I said, there's no theatre and there was not like church choirs or anything like that. But what there was is like a casino and shopping centres and pageants and a Stedfords. And so that's where I got my first performative experiences, singing in like in a Stedford and then in a shopping centre and eventually like on a TV show, which was in Melbourne, which I then won as a boy soprano. Luckily, there's no YouTube footage of it.
Yeah, we looked it up. We didn't find it.
No. Hopefully, it'll stay that way.
But do you remember what you sang?
I sang P-A-A-Z-U by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Yeah. Like, P-A-A-Z-U, P-A-A-Z-U. Yeah.
And you won with that song. What did the others sing?
Well, there was like a magician, like a kid. It was only kids. Usually it was adults, but the week I went on, it was kids. There was a magician. There was like a dance troupe. I think there was a guy like doing plate spinning or something like this. You know, like different weird acts, like also what they have now in Deutschland sucht ein Superstar, whatever. But, you know. It was the early 90s.
Everything was possible. But winning a TV show, weren't there any like music companies that like were offering you contracts?
Oh yeah, there also were those companies that made those promises. And I still don't know if they actually just weren't interested, which I would be not surprised because I look like I was going into puberty. So I'm not sure if that would really sell. Or for how long it was going to be a good financial investment. But yeah, eventually my voice broke and I stopped singing high a bit, but I still always end up singing high.
You said you sang Schubert and Schumann and so on, therefore German lyrics. Mm. Was this the reason for going to Germany or how did this happen?
Yeah, after I did that, then I was in Sydney And I did like a musical, and I was also working lots of other jobs. And I was like, I don't want to be in a commercial musical. And this is the theatre landscape of Australia is dominated by commercial musicals or a few theatre companies, but often the theatre companies only really hire like TV stars for half of their theatre performances, because they have to, you know, there's not so much funding of like of these kind of companies in Australia. So I was like at a bit of a loss as to why I had studied that, and I didn't really want to do a musical. I was working a lot of jobs as well, and then I was like, okay, I'm going to go see what Germany is like, because I'd spent so much of like opera training learning about German culture and German music, and also I was still fascinated by that Brecht Weil thing, and that's when I went to Berlin. But then it shocked me in a different way, because it was actually, you know, I was working in Sydney to pay the rent, like three different jobs, and then I could survive in Berlin way cheaper, and there was all of this theatre and there was all this other stuff going on. And then I also discovered like that there was different forms of music theater and performance and theater.
Yeah, you studied at the Universität der Künste.
Yeah.
So you also like, you didn't go the way directly to the Schauspielschule or something. Like
no.
You went in a more experimental way and you studied music, no?
First I went there like just for a year and I didn't do anything. And then, well, I did, but not. I didn't study. I did a course, actually, one course in the UdK for 1 week. And it was with Rudi Heusermann, who's like a composer and theatre, music theatre director. And he was also in the Martha Lapis Mook, the famous one. Yeah, and then I went back to Australia. And then I realized if I studied in Berlin, then I could stay there because I could get a student visa. So I studied sound studies, which was in the UdK, and it was like a sound art and sound or auditive culture, cultural studies. And it was all about listening and the anthropology of listening, and also about making sound art, performance or installation, this kind of stuff. And this was like a total complementary kind of study to classical music, but also to, you know, performance. And via that, I started to make my own performances.
And with that performances, these performances, those performances, how do you say? With
these or those performances?
And those performances, with them, you were really successful, and you started like to have, like, you got to the Hau and also to the Gorky, no?
No,
to
I've
the
Hau.
Let's say it to the Hau.
Yeah, to the Hau.
Let's leave it at the Hau.
Yeah.
And Matthias Lilienthal took you with to Munich 3 years ago. And you could say Damien Repgert was at that time everything Munich was afraid of. Not German speaking, performing, not acting actor. You seemed perfectly equipped to be the arch enemy of the new Kammerspiele. How did it feel? How have you been received?
Yeah, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. A lot of people said, oh, I said to people in Berlin, oh, I'm going to Munich. And they were like, you're going to Munich? Really? And I was like, I don't really understand this. But then later I understood a bit more what they were saying. I mean, it was tricky because I was going into this acting institution. I mean, well, it's not an acting institution. It's a theater institution, but into an acting ensemble. But but it was framed that there was performance and acting. And I think a lot of people felt that so much focus on performance being contemporary made acting old-fashioned or not so contemporary. And so there was a dynamic that that started to open up around this binary of like acting versus performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself on one side. And now I actually think maybe I should have been more provocative, or maybe I should have even owned that more and being more like, yeah, I'm from the free scene, I'm a performer, and I'm here, and you can all just make space for me. But I took a more diplomatic way and thinking, yeah, I don't really see myself as a performer, because actually performer isn't even a thing in English. You kind of just say that you're a theatre maker or you're an actor. But I don't see what the difference is, and I don't like these labels. And that was the way that I negotiated that. But yeah, definitely I felt like maybe it could have been my paranoia, but I definitely felt like there were audience and at times other people I was working with sort of looking at me going, what the hell are you doing here? And yeah, I mean, that's Matthias Lilienthal though. He likes to create a chaos and then the energy that comes with that chaos, and hopefully it exposes things, and it worked because it did expose a lot of like conservative ideas about what theatre is or what theatre should be. On the other hand, it also created a fight in which a lot of people didn't come to the theatre, and also, yeah, where we got, like, I got booed in Einzelapplaus, which I'd never had before in my life. And I was like, whoa.
I won a talent show, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't you know? I won $3,000 when I was 13 on a talent show. Why are you booing?
How dare you?
Yeah. It's incredible. Like, we performed just 2 weeks ago in Paris, Femme Fatale from Philip Kent. And after two shows, the rest of the shows were ausverkauft, standing ovations. And it is, I think, like a very... Like, I enjoy it, but I think it is a good, very good piece. Not just because I enjoy it, but of course I'm biased. I'm in it. And then in Munich, when we do the same piece, after a couple of shows, there's 40 people there and they don't really know how to take it. And it just happened so many times over the years that we would go somewhere else and perform something, and people were really open and really enjoyed it. But that when we returned here, people couldn't not see things outside of the prism of like this theatre debate and outside of what they'd read in the newspaper. And yeah, that just was really, really annoying because it was frustrating. But it's also just shows how important all of these politics are. But it's also like good that it is exposed. I mean, it is exposed that we are the theater of the year, but in this city, half, like, it's only ever half full, and people don't seem that into it. So what does that say about things? I don't know.
Damien, your next project, you even reached a new stage. End of October, you're going to have your premiere as a director. You're doing a play on Nirvana's last concert, which took part in Munich. Kurt Cobain shot himself shortly after. I hope there is no connection between these two facts.
No audience. There was no audience. Yeah. As usual.
You were 14,
yeah,
right?
But I don't remember it. I mean, the big Nirvana phase happened in 1991, 92. And then I was like 12 or 13. And because, yeah, as we know, I was doing Sopranos.
Mozart.
Mozart. I was, yeah, it wasn't really like totally my kind of music. I like Smashing Pumpkins, but that sort of came after. And I can't remember Kurt Cobain's death. I've tried to remember that day, but I can't remember it. So I didn't understand his cultural significance at that time.
So you were not one of these guys who like listened to Nirvana and then decided, I have to start my own band and cause
grunge. I think I wish I was. Grunge. I wished I was one of those guys, but I wasn't. I was more into like Mariah Carey.
What did interest you on Kurt Cobain, or about if it wasn't the music and his lifestyle, or whatever?
I think it's like that, like fragility and his softness, and then also the like energy of the music. But also then thinking about like this experiment with Matthias Lilienthal, like that he takes the free scene and then brings it into the mainstream of Stadttheater. I don't know, that's why he actually said, would you like to do a David Bowie concert? And I was like, no. And then he knew I liked Whitney Houston, and I said, no, I'm not doing Whitney Houston. And then I said, I think maybe Nirvana, because it had a kind of strange parallel between of like a band that's like independent and grassroots and then sells out and crosses over to the big scale Hollywood success and like, and then changes, which is obviously not what I did when I came to Stadttheater in Munich under Matthias Lilienthal. But there's a kind of like strange thing also, like I felt like I was a bit betraying the free scene to go into Stadttheater, or I was betraying what it is to be a performer, to put myself into a system in which I am like an actor in other people's works. You know, I thought that it would be a kind of place that where the experiment would lead to kind of different people directing each other, and where these roles would be more fluid. And in a utopian theatre, Stadttheater, it could, maybe that's possible in the future, but it wasn't really possible at this time. Although now I am directing a piece, even though I don't think of myself as only as a director or an actor or something, but more like a theater maker.
But what is it that makes you interested in the Nirvana stuff as, how you said, as a theater maker?
This Nirvana thing had like this weird echo. And also because of like the younger public and not doing David Bowie, which is like but really kind of coming in with these 90s kids or working out what if it's even possible to do something with Nirvana, because it's also felt like taboo to do Nirvana in the Kammer Eins. And then after that, I found out they did their last concert here in Munich. And then it became like interesting on a whole other level, because like there is a poetry to it that after that they came from Aberdeen, a little town in Aberdeen in, you know, the north of USA, and their last concert was in Munich, and it was in an old Flughafen, like that's also designed by the same architect who designed the Flughafen, the Nazi architect who designs the one in Berlin. And it was also, this Flughafen now doesn't exist, and it was a Zwischennutzung of a cultural space that also contained like one of Munich's most legendary techno clubs, like Ultraschall. And that this space, it became so like mythical in my head, and also interesting because it was just there for 5 years, and it was in an old Flughafen. And also the whole thing that like there was the Flughafen in Berlin, and there were fights over which theater would take over that or who wanted it. And it was always like this idea that Matthias Lilienthal just really wanted to have that Flughafen. but this Flughafen here was then kind of turned into a Messestadt, and now it's owned by Luxembourg Fonds. And you go there and it's like workers, and there's like a cantina, and there's just like one little space that's still there. So it's interesting about also to remember that space. And then of course it became like, now the actual piece is about a kind of Beirifizierung of Nirvana. You know, it's like a Heimatstück, but it's Nirvana. And it's like, we've completely sold out, you know, to our audience by making a Bavarian Heimatstück for them. With Nirvana, which is also will be theirs forever, because their last concert will forever be in Munich, you know what I mean? So it's sort of like, and it's done with a lot of, it's beautiful music and like amazing people in it. And, but it's also a kind of like bittersweet, like way to finish this time here. For me personally, but also like what's interesting is then because of this experience of like trying to find people that were at the concert 25 years ago in Munich, now I started to talk to all different people and have these conversations about Munich. And it was a healing thing for me because I'd started to project a lot of things onto the city or whatever.
You were saying it's a bittersweet thing to go in this year with this piece, Nirvana. And it sounded a little bit, that it wasn't your happiest time the last years, and now that the time of Lilienthal ended in Munich. So what are your plans for afterwards?
Actually, I don't have any plans, except that because my boyfriend lives in Rotterdam, and I have lived 4 years here in a long distance relationship, that I'll spend some time there. But I don't have any plans to make, like, to join any new ensemble or anything, or a new theatre or anything like that. I think I would like to take some time just to process that everything that happened. And I mean, I guess it wasn't the easiest time, but I should also say it was. I'm very lucky, and I really enjoyed it, and I have amazing colleagues, and I got to be in some really incredible pieces. So it wasn't like a bad experience at all. It was an incredible time, but it was eye-opening about, like, what a microcosmos the theatre can be, and what conflicts it can bring out. And maybe that's actually what I need to kind of think about, is how productive many of those conflicts were and will continue to be, even though this will be over. But of course, a part of me does, like, think, oh, maybe they should have kept on going a bit longer. Like, maybe they should have really made sure that Lilienthal didn't leave. But that's the politics of it too. It was the politics at play.
So, Damien Rapgut, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. I hope that I didn't answer too slowly.
No, not at all.
Thank you for doing it in English. Well done. You guys are amazing.
No, it was hard. No, at some point, how many grammar mistakes did we do?
I don't know. Probably I made just as many grammar mistakes as you.
Aber hier das Oxford Dictionary wurde nicht gebraucht.
Yeah, also another stupid joke that didn't work out in the end.
I like stupid jokes. Yeah. No, it's very big. It's very heavy for all of those people listening at home. I mean, it's a very big dictionary, what they have.
Das war Verriss und Vorurteil mit Bene Maler, Maximilian Zippenauer und der wunderbaren Anna Landefeld. Wir bedanken uns fürs Zuhören.
Ciao.
Ciao.